frustration tolerance. Crystal clear is that the explosiveness of many children is being fueled by a
fairly
chronic state of irritability and agitation that makes it hard for them to respond to life's routine frustrations in an adaptive, rational manner. Mother: Mickey, why so grumpy? It's a beautiful day outside. Why are you indoors? Mickey, slumped in a chair, agitated: It's windy. Mother: It's windy? Mickey,
more agitated:
I said it's windy. I hate wind. Mother: Mickey, you could be out playing basketball, swimming. You're this upset over a little wind? Mickey, very agitated: It's too windy. Damn it. Leave me alone. Anxiety falls under the emotion regulation skills category as well because, similar to irritability, anxiety has the potential to make rational thought much more difficult. Of course, it's when we're anxious about something, a monster under the bed, an upcoming test, a new or unpredictable situation, that clear thinking is most crucial. This combination of anxiety and irrationality causes some children, the lucky ones, to cry. But a substantial number of them, the unlucky ones, explode. The criers are the lucky ones because we adults tend to take things far less personally and respond far more empathetically to children who cry than we do to children who explode, even though the two behaviors often emanate from the same source. Also, it seems pretty clear that many obsessive compulsive children begin ritualizing because, in the absence of rational thought, the rituals are the only things they can come up with to reduce their anxiety. Let's use me as an example. I used to be flight anxious. That's right, scared of flying. No, I wasn't intentionally being anxious, sweaty palms, racing heart, catastrophic thoughts. So flight attendants would pay attention to me. I was truly unnerved to find myself 5 miles above the earth, going 500 miles per hour in an aluminum apparatus filled with gasoline, with my life in the hands of people, the pilots and air traffic controllers, I'd never met. To control this anxiety, I used to engage in a few important rituals to ensure the safe progress of my flight. I had to sit in a window seat so I could scan the skies for oncoming aircraft, and had to review the emergency instruction card before the plane took off. I knew these rituals worked because all the flights I'd been on had delivered me safely to my destination. Did these rituals cause me to behave oddly at times? On one flight, my plane was cruising along at 33,000 feet or so, and I was, as usual, vigilantly scanning the horizon for threatening aircraft. Then the unthinkable happened. I spotted an aircraft far off on the horizon, ascending in the general direction of my airplane. By my expert calculation, we had about 5 minutes before the paths of the two planes crossed, and my life would come to an abrupt, fiery end. So I did what any very anxious, increasingly irrational human being would do. I rang for the flight attendant. There was no time to spare. "Do you see the airplane down there?" I sputtered, pointing toward the speck many miles off in the distance. She peered out the window. "Do you think the captain knows it's there?" I demanded. The flight attendant tried to hide her amusement, or amazement, I wasn't sure which, and said, "I'll be sure to let him know." I was greatly relieved, albeit certain that my heroism was not fully appreciated by either the flight attendant or the passenger seated near me, who were now scanning for empty seats to move to. The plane landed safely, of course, and as I was leaving the airplane once we'd landed, the flight attendant and pilot were waiting at the door and smiled as I approached. The flight attendant tugged on the pilot's sleeve and introduced me. "Captain, this is the gentleman who was helping you fly the plane." I'm proud to say that although I still generally prefer window seats, I no longer scan the skies for oncoming aircraft or review the emergency manual, and have survived hundreds of flights on which I did neither. How did I get over my flight anxiety? Experience, and by thinking clearly. An Air Florida pilot got the process going. As I was boarding this Air Florida flight, the captain was greeting passengers at the door of the aircraft. I seized the opportunity. "You're going to fly the plane safely, aren't you?" I sputtered. The pilot's response was more helpful than he knew.
What, you think I want to die, buddy?
That the pilot wasn't particularly enthusiastic about dying was an important revelation, and it got me thinking about the thousands of planes in the air across the world at any given time, and the slim odds of something disastrous happening to the plane that I was on, about the millions of flights that arrive at their destinations uneventfully each year,
about the many, many flights I've been on that arrived safely,
about how calm the flight attendants look, about how many of my fellow passengers are fast asleep, even when there's turbulence. Quite unintentionally, that Air Florida pilot had given me a new way of thinking, which was helpful to me during moments when I was inclined to become highly irrational. Instead of staring out the window thinking, what if the wing falls off, I could instead think a less anxiety-provoking thought, such as, the pilot doesn't want to die, or the likelihood of something catastrophic happening to my aircraft is really quite slim. As you'll see, one of the most valuable things we can do for an explosive child is to help him stay rational at times when he's likely to become irrational. Can irritable or anxious children be helped to problem solve more adaptively and at the same time reduce their irritability and anxiety? Certainly. But not by putting a lot of effort into coming up with new and creative ways to punish them.
Cognitive flexibility skills. Very young children tend to be fairly rigid, black and white, literal, inflexible thinkers. That's because they're still making sense of the world, and it's easier to put two and two together if you don't have to worry about exceptions to the rule or alternative ways of looking at things. As children develop, they learn that, in fact, most things in life are gray. There are exceptions to the rule and alternative ways of interpreting things. We don't go home from grandma's house the same way every time. We don't eat dinner at the exact same time every day, and the weather doesn't always cooperate with our plans. Unfortunately, for some children, gray thinking doesn't develop as readily as we might wish. Though they are often diagnosed with disorders, such as nonverbal learning disability or Asperger's disorder, these children can best be thought of as black and white thinkers stuck in a gray world. They often have significant difficulty approaching the world in a flexible, adaptable way and become extremely frustrated when events don't proceed as they had originally configured. More specifically, these children often have a strong preference for predictability and routines and struggle when events are unpredictable, uncertain, and ambiguous. These are the kids who run into trouble when they need to adjust or reconfigure their expectations, tend to overfocus on facts and details, and often have trouble recognizing the obvious or seeing the big picture. In practical terms, this is the child who may insist on going out for recess at a certain time on a given day because it is the time the class always goes out for recess, failing to take into account both the likely consequences of insisting on the original plan of action. Example, being at recess alone and important conditions, an assembly, perhaps, that would suggest the need for an adaptation in plan. These children may experience enormous frustration as they struggle to apply concrete rules to a world where few such rules apply.
Child in car.
Dad, this isn't the way we usually go home.
Father, driving. I thought we'd go a different way this time, just for a change of pace. Child.
But this isn't the right way.
Father. I know this isn't the way we usually go, but it may even be faster. Child.
We can't go this way. It's not the same. I don't know this way.
Father, look, it's not that big a deal to go a different way every once in a while.
Child, kaboom.
If you're guessing that Jennifer, star of the waffle episode in Chapter 1, was a black and white thinker stuck in a gray world, you'd be right.
Can the Jennifers of the world be helped to approach the world in a more flexible manner?
You bet.
But not if the adults around them are busy being inflexible themselves.
Social skills.
There are few human activities that require more flexibility, complex thinking, and rapid processing than social interactions. Researchers have delineated a set of specific thinking skills known as social information processing skills
that come into play in practically all social interactions. A brief review of these thinking skills will help you understand just how frustrating social interactions can be, especially for children who aren't good at them, and how lagging social skills can set the stage for explosions. Let's say a boy is standing in a hallway at school, and a peer comes up and, with a big smile on his face, whacks the boy hard on the back and says, "Hi." The boy who was whacked on the back now has a split second to attend to and try to pick up on the important qualities of the social cues of this situation. Who just whacked me on the back? Aside from the person's smile, is there anything about his posture or facial expression or this context that tells me whether this was a friendly or unfriendly smile and a whack? At the same time, he must connect those cues with his previous experiences. When have other people, and this person in particular, whacked me on the back and smiled at me before? In order to interpret the cue, was this an overexuberant greeting or an aggressive act? Then he has to think about what he wants to have happen next. That was a mean thing to do. I'd like to avoid getting into a fight with this person. Or, that was a nice greeting. Then, on the basis of his interpretation of the cue and the outcome he desires, the boy must begin to think about how to respond, either by remembering his experiences in similar situations or by thinking of new responses. Then he must evaluate the different possible responses. Consider the likely outcomes of each. If I smile back, he'll probably ask me to play a game with him. Choose a response, enact it, monitor the course of events throughout, and adjust the response accordingly. Sounds like a lot of thinking for one event. Yes? The key point is that this process is non-stop and requires a lot of efficiency and flexibility. It's barely noticeable to people for whom it happens automatically, but it's very frustrating if you're not one of those people. Many explosive children have trouble attending to appropriate social cues and nuances, do not accurately interpret those cues. "He hates me. Everybody's out to get me. No one likes me." Are inefficient at connecting cues with past experience may not be very efficient at considering how they want a social interaction to ensue, may have a limited repertoire of responses and end up applying the identical responses, giggling, poking, intruding, to situations in which such responses are inappropriate, may be quite unskilled at recognizing how they're coming across or appreciating how much their behavior is affecting others, and may lack the skills for handling the most basic of social interactions, starting a conversation, entering a group, sharing. Such children who suffer from what Daniel Goleman has referred to as emotional illiteracy are likely to find social interactions extremely frustrating. This can, at the least, contribute to the child's general level of frustration. At worst, it may lead to a chronic pattern of explosions. Can these children be helped to develop more adaptive social skills? Yes, usually. It does take a while, but only if adults recognize that trying hard to motivate a child who's already motivated to do well wouldn't be the best way to go about teaching the social skills that are lacking. Just in case you were wondering, children are often deficient in skills that cut across multiple pathways. Perhaps the most important thing the pathways can help us understand is that flexibility and frustration tolerance are not skills that come naturally to all children. We tend to think that all children are created equal in these capacities, and this tendency causes many adults to believe that explosive children must not want to be compliant and handle frustration in an adaptable way. As you now know, in most cases, this simply isn't true. By the way, there's a big difference between interpreting the pathways described in this chapter as excuses rather than as explanations. When the pathways are invoked as excuses, the door slams shut on the process of thinking about how to help a child. Conversely, when the pathways are used as explanations for a child's behavior, the door to helping swings wide open, for the pathways provide us with an improved understanding of the child's needs and a clearer sense of what we need to do next. It's very difficult to be helpful without this comprehensive, in-depth understanding of a child's difficulties. Triggers. There's one other piece of terminology to cover before the chapter ends. Triggers. What's a trigger? A situation or event that routinely precipitates explosive outbursts. Triggers can best be thought of as problems that have yet to be solved.
The possibilities are endless. But here's the shortlist. Homework, sensory hypersensitivities, tics, sibling interactions, bedtime, waking up in the morning, meals, being bored, writing in the car, recess, being teased, reading, writing, being tired, being hot, or being hungry. So while the pathways are what set the stage for a child to be explosive, skills that need to be trained, triggers are the situations or events over which the child is actually exploding. Help the child develop the thinking skills and solve the problems, and there won't be any more explosions. Once you know what your child's pathways and triggers are, his explosions become highly predictable. Lots of folks believe that a child's explosions are unpredictable and occur out of the blue. But that theory is seldom substantiated for reasons that will become much clearer in Chapter 6. Predictable explosions are a lot easier to deal with than unpredictable ones.
Chapter 4. Pathways and Triggers Brought to Life.
As you might imagine, given the different pathways and triggers that could be involved with each individual child, inflexibility and poor frustration tolerance can look different in different children, so that the characteristics you've read about start to come to life. It's useful for you to have a good idea of what they look like in other kids. You'll probably see similarities between the children described in this chapter and the explosive child you're trying to parent or teach. These children and their families are revisited in one way or another throughout the book. Casey. Casey was a 6-year-old boy who lived with his parents and younger sister. His parents reported that, at home, Casey was very hyperactive, had difficulty playing by himself, but wasn't great at playing with other kids either, and had a lot of difficulty with transitions. Getting him to come indoors after playing outside was often a major ordeal. His parents also reported that Casey seemed to be quite bright, in that he had excellent memory for factual information, but that he became anxious when presented with new tasks or situations, and was frequently in an irritable, agitated mood. The parents had read a lot about ADHD. While they thought that this diagnosis fit Casey, they felt that many of his difficulties fell outside the realm of this disorder. They thought the term control freak fit their son better than any traditional diagnosis. Casey was quite restricted and rigid in the clothes he was willing to wear and the food he was willing to eat. He often complained that certain fabrics were annoying to him and that many common foods smelled funny. Most of these characteristics had been present since Casey was a toddler. His parents had previously consulted a psychologist who helped them establish a reward and punishment program. The parents vigilantly implemented the program, but found that Casey's hyperactivity, inflexibility, and irritability were more potent than his clear desire to obtain rewards and avoid punishments. Indeed, the program actually seemed to frustrate him further, but the psychologist encouraged his parents to stick with it, certain that Casey's behavior would improve. It didn't, so the parents discontinued the program after about 3 months. They often tried to talk to Casey about his behavior, but even when he was in a good mood, his capacity for thinking about his own behavior seemed limited. After a few seconds, he would yell, "I can't talk about this right now," and run out of the room. Casey had difficulties at school, too. His first grade teacher reported that Casey would occasionally hit or yell at other children during less structured activities, particularly when he did not get his way. Like the parents, Casey's teacher was impressed by his factual knowledge, but concerned by his poor problem-solving skills. When lessons called for recall of rote information, Casey was the star of the class. When lessons required the application of this information to more abstract, complex, real-life situations, his responses were disorganized and off the mark. When he was frustrated by a particular classroom situation or task, he would yell, "I can't do this," and would become quite agitated or start crying. Sometimes he would run out of the classroom. On several occasions, he ran out of the school, which caused great concern for his safety. Sometimes he regained his composure quickly. Other times, it took 20 to 30 minutes for him to calm down. Afterward, Casey was either remorseful, "I'm sorry I ran out of the classroom. I know I shouldn't do that," or had difficulty remembering the episode altogether. Casey's teacher reported that she could often tell from the moment Casey walked through the door in the morning that he was going to have a tough day. But she also observed that Casey was capable of falling apart even when his day seemed to be going smoothly. The teacher was becoming increasingly concerned about Casey's relationships with other children. Casey seemed to lack an appreciation for the impact of his actions on others and seemed unable to use the feedback he received from others to adjust his behavior. In Casey's first session with a new therapist, he was very hyperactive and seemed unwilling or unable to talk about the important problems that he might need help with. He bounced from one toy to another in the therapist's office. When his parents were brought into the session, he settled down just long enough to hear that the reason he had been brought to another psychologist was that he sometimes became upset when things didn't go exactly the way he thought they would. He agreed that this was sometimes a problem. When the parents tried to get Casey to talk about this issue, he buried his face in his mother's shoulder. When the parents persisted, he warned, "I can't talk about this right now." When they persisted further, he became red-faced and agitated and ran out of the office. "Was that pretty typical?" the therapist asked the parents. "No, at home he'd become a lot more frustrated," replied his mother. "He doesn't usually hit us, although he has hit kids at school, but he falls apart completely, turns red, screams or cries, yells, 'I hate you!'" "You know, in some ways, his running out of the room is adaptive," the therapist commented. "How's that?" asked the father, a little surprised. "Well, based on what you've told me, it seems pretty clear that he has a lot of trouble thinking and talking about his own behavior and tolerating the frustration he feels when we ask him to do things," the therapist said. "While we wish he would use his words to discuss things with us, his running out of the room probably keeps him from doing other things, swearing, throwing things, becoming physically threatening. That would be a lot worse." "We can live with a lot of Casey's behaviors," said his mother. "But his explosions and the way they disrupt our entire family and our concern about what's going to happen to him if we don't help him really worry us." What were Casey's pathways? So far, it seems reasonable to hypothesize that difficulty-shifting cognitive set, executive, irritability, emotion regulation, discomfort with new tasks or situations, cognitive flexibility, and possibly social difficulties were setting the stage for his explosions. Whether Casey's difficulty talking about his problems reflected lagging language processing skills wasn't yet clear. In terms of triggers, sensory hypersensitivities certainly seemed to be coming into play. Thus, the initial goal was to achieve greater certainty on Casey's pathways so as to identify skills that he needed to learn and to develop a comprehensive list of triggers in order to identify the specific problems that needed to be solved. Whether medications for reducing hyperactivity or impulsivity and reducing irritability might be necessary wasn't yet certain. Helen and her mother and father first sought help for her explosions when she was 7 years old. Helen was described as a charming, sensitive, creative, energetic, sociable girl. Her parents also described her as intense, easily angered, argumentative, resistant, and downright nasty when frustrated. They had observed that Helen seemed to have a lot of trouble making the transition from one activity to another and tended to fall apart when things didn't go exactly as she had anticipated. They reported that weekends were especially difficult. Although Helen didn't love going to school, she became bored during unstructured weekend time and became very difficult to please. Helen's piano teacher observed that Helen tended to become easily frustrated and often balked at trying new pieces of music. Her second grade teacher reported that Helen had a tendency to grumble when new lessons were introduced. Psychoeducational testing indicated that while Helen was above average in intelligence, her expressive language skills were delayed. If you're thinking, based on the above information, that the language and cognitive flexibility pathways might be coming into play, you may be onto something. In one of their early meetings with Helen's therapist, her parents recounted one of her explosions during the previous week.
On Tuesday, Helen told me she'd like to have chili for dinner the next night, recalled her father. So, on Wednesday afternoon, I left work a little early and made her the chili she had asked for. When she got home from swimming late Wednesday afternoon, she seemed a little tired. When I announced to her that I had made her the chili she wanted, she grumbled, "I want macaroni and cheese." This took me a little bit by surprise, since I know she really loves chili. It was also a little irritating, since I had put time into doing something nice for her. So I told her she would have to eat the chili. But she seemed unable to get macaroni and cheese out of her head, and I continued to insist that she eat the chili for dinner. The more I insisted, the more she fell apart. Eventually, she lost it completely. She was screaming and crying, but I was determined that she would eat the chili I made her.
"What did you do then?" the therapist asked.
"We sent her to her bedroom and told her she had to stay there until she was ready to eat the chili," said Helen's mother. For the next hour, she screamed and cried in her room. At one point, she was banging on her mirror and broke it. Can you imagine? All this over chili. I went up to her room a few times to see if I could calm her down, but it was impossible. Helen was totally irrational. The amazing thing is that at one point, she couldn't even remember what she was upset about.
"Why was it so important to you that she eat the chili instead of the macaroni and cheese?" the therapist asked.
"Because I inconvenienced myself to do something nice for her," the father responded. "Sounds like a legitimate concern to me," the therapist said. "Do you think that you're enduring this explosion, having Helen go nuts in her room for an hour, breaking her mirror, and ruining your evening, made it any less likely that she'll explode the next time she's frustrated over something similar?" the therapist asked.
"No,"
was the instantaneous, unanimous response. "What was Helen like when the episode was all over?" the therapist asked.
"Very remorseful and very loving," the mother responded.
"It's hard to know whether to reciprocate her affection or to hold a grudge for a while to cement the point that we don't like that kind of behavior."
"Well," the therapist replied, "if you don't think that inducing and enduring explosions is going to help her deal better with frustration the next time, then it follows that holding a grudge probably isn't going to help either."
"Yes, but will she learn that that kind of behavior is unacceptable?" asked the mother. "From what I can gather," the therapist said, "the fact that you disapprove of that kind of behavior is pretty well cemented in her mind already. So I doubt that we'll be needing more cement. She also seems genuinely motivated to please you both, and seems as unhappy about her explosions as you are. So I'm not sure she needs additional motivation." What Helen and her parents did need was a different way to resolve disagreements and problems. "We've got some skills to teach Helen," the therapist continued. "We need to help her deal better with uncertainty and unpredictability, and it sounds like we might have some language skills to teach her as well. I also want to get a much better sense about the precise situations that are causing a lot of explosions. Then we'll know what problems we need to solve. I'd like you to do me a favor. Make me a list during the coming week of all the situations in which Helen became frustrated. My bet is that there are probably 7 or 8 triggers, accounting for most of her explosions. The list will help me know what those are." Danny. Danny was a 5th grader whose mother and father had divorced amicably when Danny was 7 and still considered themselves co-parents. Danny and his younger sister stayed with the father and his fiancée every weekend. The mother described Danny as very bright, perfectionistic, moody, irritable, and, as fate would have it, very easily frustrated. The mother was especially concerned about Danny's rage attacks, which had occurred several times a week since Danny was a toddler. During such episodes, he would become verbally abusive and physically aggressive. The mother was also worried about how these attacks were affecting Danny's sister, who, at times, seemed scared of her older brother and, at other times, seemed to take some pleasure in provoking him. Danny had never had a rage attack at school. He had seen numerous mental health professionals over the years.
Like many explosive kids, Danny accumulated a fairly impressive number of psychiatric diagnoses, including oppositional defiant disorder, depression, and bipolar disorder. His family physician had medicated Danny with Ritalin several years previously, but Danny had remained moody, rigid, and explosive. A psychiatrist had subsequently prescribed an antidepressant, but this medication caused Danny to become significantly more agitated and hyperactive. Danny can be in what seems to be a perfectly pleasant mood, and then, bang! Something doesn't quite go the way he thought it would, his mother reported, and hitting. I don't know what to do. The other day, he and I were in the car together, and I took a wrong turn. Danny suddenly became very agitated that it was taking us longer to get where we were going than it should have. All of a sudden, I had a 10-year-old kid punching me in the car while I'm driving. It's insanity. I'm tired of people telling me behavior is occurring because I'm a single parent. My ex-husband is still very much involved in Danny's life. And there hasn't been any of the backstabbing that takes place with some divorces. I will say, I think his dad tries too hard to be Danny's best friend. Anyway, these explosions started way before there were problems in our marriage. Although I must admit, he's a lot more explosive when he's with me than he is when he's with his father. In conversations with his new therapist, Danny seemed genuinely contrite over the behavior his mother had described. He said he'd been trying very hard not to be physically or verbally aggressive, but didn't seem to be able to help himself. The therapist's sense early on was that Danny's extreme irritability was a major factor contributing to his explosions. There was also some suggestion that black and white thinking, the cognitive flexibility pathway, might be coming into play. He said he exploded more with his mother because she nags too much. At the beginning of one session, the mother described Danny's biggest explosion of the week. Yesterday, I told him he had to come in from playing basketball to eat dinner. He whined a little, but I insisted. Next thing I know, his face is red, he's calling me every name in the book, he's accusing me of ruining his life, and I'm hiding behind a door, trying to shield myself from getting kicked. I was petrified, so was his sister, and it's not the first time. 20 minutes later, he was sorry, but this is just ridiculous, said the mother. I'm sick of being hit, and it's just impossible to reason with him once he gets going. What did you do once he'd calmed down? The therapist asked. I punished him for swearing at me and trying to kick me, replied the mother. I feel he needs to be disciplined for that kind of behavior. I can understand you feeling that way. Tell me, have you always punished when he's acted like that? The therapist asked. You bet, the mother said. I'm not willing to just let that kind of disrespect slide. What happens when you punish him? The therapist asked. He goes nuts, she said. It's horrible. But despite all the punishing, he's still very verbally and physically aggressive, yes? That's why I'm here, the mother said, smiling through gritted teeth. Well, the therapist said, I'm all in favor of punishment when it's productive, you know, when it's effective at changing a child's behavior. But I'm not real keen on punishment just for the sake of punishment. What? I should let him get away with what he does? Demanded the mother. Don't get me wrong, the therapist said. We need to help him stop exploding and hitting, but based on what you've been telling me, not letting him get away with it hasn't changed his behavior at all. The mother pondered this observation for a moment. I think I figured that eventually the message would get through if I just kept plugging away, she explained. I never stopped to think that maybe the message would never get through. Oh, I suspect Danny knows you don't like his behavior, the therapist said. In fact, I'm reasonably certain he even knows how you'd like him to behave. Then why doesn't he? The mother demanded. Now that I've met with Danny a few times, I get the feeling he's generally in a pretty cranky mood. I know he's not crazy about coming here, but is that his mood most of the time? The therapist asked. Absolutely, replied the mother.
We call him grumpy. He doesn't seem to enjoy himself very much.
And he's very uptight. Everything seems to bother him.
What an unpleasant existence, the therapist said, and it has very unpleasant implications for everyone around him.
You can say that again, the mother sighed. But what does that have to do with his being explosive and angry and trying to hurt me?
Well, if we view him as grumpy and irritable, rather than as disrespectful and oppositional, then I think our approach to dealing with him might look a lot different, the therapist said.
I don't understand what you mean, said the mother.
What I mean is that kids who are grumpy and irritable often don't need more discipline, the therapist said. I've yet to see discipline be especially useful at helping a kid be less irritable and agitated.
I still don't understand how being irritable is an excuse for his being so disrespectful and angry toward me, said the mother.
Well, it's more of an explanation than an excuse, the therapist replied.
But when people go through the day in an irritable, cranky mood, they experience every request or change or inconvenience as yet another demand for an expenditure of energy. If you think about it, over the course of a day or a week, a person's energy for dealing with these requests and changes and inconveniences starts to wane. Often, the event that sends an irritable, cranky person over the edge isn't necessarily the biggest. Rather, it's the one that happened after he'd expended his last ounce of energy.
Think of the times you've been tired after a long day at work, the therapist continued. Those are probably the times when you're least adaptable and least flexible and when very minor things are likely to set you off.
I think Danny is in the state of mind fairly continuously.
There's no way I'm going to tell him he's allowed to hit me just because he's irritable, said the mother.
Oh, I'm not saying you should allow him to hit you, the therapist said. The hitting has got to stop. But to get the hitting and swearing and tantrums to stop, I think we need to focus on things you can do before he explodes, rather than on what you can do after he exploded. And we need to focus on all the ingredients that are fueling his inflexibility and explosiveness. From what I've seen so far, helping him with his irritability will be high on the list.
Mitchell was dragged into yet another therapist's office from an initial appointment when he was a 15-year-old ninth grader. The therapist met first with Mitchell's mother, a law professor, and father, a practicing lawyer, and was told that Mitchell had been diagnosed with both Tourette's disorder and bipolar disorder, but was refusing all medication except an antihypertensive, which he was taking to control his tics. The therapist, who was also told that Mitchell was extremely unhappy about having been brought to his office that day, for he greatly distrusted mental health professionals. The parents reported that Mitchell was extremely irritable. Emotion regulation pathway, had no friends, social skills pathway, and became frustrated at the drop of a hat. But aside from pathways, a key to understanding Mitchell's difficulties was watching him interact with his parents. The parents reported that Mitchell, their youngest child, the others were already living away from home, was extremely bright and very eccentric. But he was repeating the ninth grade because of a very rough time he'd had at a local prep school the year before.
This is a classic case of wasted potential, said the father. We were devastated by what happened last year.
What happened? The therapist asked.
He just plain bombed out of prep school, said the father.
Here is a kid with an IQ in the 140s, and he's not making it at one of the area's top prep schools.
He practically had a nervous breakdown over it. He had to be hospitalized for a week because he tried to slit his wrist.
That sounds very serious and very scary.
How is he now? The therapist asked.
Lousy, said the mother.
He has no self-esteem left. He's lost all faith in himself, and he doesn't seem to be able to complete any schoolwork at all anymore. We think he's depressed.
Where is he going to school now? The therapist asked.
Our local high school, the mother replied. They're very nice there and everything, but we don't think he's being challenged by the work, bright as he is.
Of course, there's more to doing well in school besides smarts, the therapist said.
Can I take a look at the testing you had done?
The parents gave the therapist a copy of
a psychoeducational
evaluation that had been performed when Mitchell was in the seventh grade. The report documented a 25-point discrepancy between his exceptional verbal skills and average nonverbal skills, difficulty on tasks sensitive to distractibility, very slow processing speed, and below average written language skills. But the examiner had concluded that Mitchell had no difficulties that would interfere with his learning.
"This is an interesting report," the therapist said.
"How's that?" said the father.
"Well, it may give us some clues as to why Mitchell might be struggling to live up to everyone's expectations," the therapist said.
"We were told he had no learning problems," the mother said.
"I think that was probably inaccurate," the therapist said. He then explained the potential ramifications of some of the evaluation findings. As they talked, it became clearer that Mitchell was indeed struggling most on tasks involving a lot of writing, problem-solving, rapid processing, and sustained effort.
"That's something we're going to have to take a closer look at," the therapist said.
"Of course, he's still very bright," said the father.
"There are some areas in which he is clearly quite bright," the therapist said,
"and some areas that may be making it very hard for him to show how bright he is. My bet is that he finds that disparity quite frustrating."
"Oh, he's frustrated all right," said the mother.
"We all are."
After a while, Mitchell was invited to come into the office. He refused to meet with the therapist alone, so his parents remained in the room.
"I'm sick of mental health professionals," Mitchell announced from the outset.
"How come?" the therapist asked.
"Never had much use for them. None of them has ever done me any good," Mitchell answered.
"Don't be rude, Mitchell," his father intoned.
"Shut up, father," Mitchell boomed. "He wasn't talking to you."
The storm passed quickly.
"It sounds like you've been through quite a bit in the past 2 years," the therapist said.
"What did you tell him?" Mitchell boomed at his parents.
"We told him about the trouble you had in prep school," the mother answered, "and about your being suicidal, and about how we don't..."
"Enough!" Mitchell screamed. "I don't know this man from Adam, and you've already told him my life story. And I wouldn't have been suicidal if I hadn't been on about 87 different medications at the time."
"What were you taking back then?" the therapist asked.
"I don't know," Mitchell said, rubbing hard on his forehead.
"You tell him, mother."
"I think he's been on about every psychiatric drug known to mankind," said the mother.
"Lithium, Prozac..."
"Stop exaggerating, mother," Mitchell boomed.
"Mitchell, don't be rude to your mother," said the father.
"If you can't stop telling me to be rude, I'm leaving," Mitchell screamed.
Once again, the storm quickly subsided. "What medicines are you taking now?" the therapist asked.
"Just something for my tics," Mitchell replied.
"And don't even think about telling me to take something else."
"Let's just get off this topic."
"He doesn't even take his tic medication all the time," said the mother.
"That's why he still tics so much."
"That's why he still tics so much."
"Mother, stop!" Mitchell boomed. "I don't care about the tics. Leave me alone about them."
"It's just that..." the mother began speaking again.
"Mother, no!"
Mitchell boomed.
His mother stopped.
"Mitchell, are you suicidal now?" the therapist asked.
"No, and if you ask me that again, I'm leaving."
"He still doesn't feel very good about himself, though," the father said.
"I feel just fine," Mitchell boomed. "You're the ones who need a psychologist, not me."
Mitchell turned to the therapist.
"Can you do something about them?"
The father chuckled at this question.
"What's so funny?"
Mitchell boomed.
"If I might interrupt," the therapist said,
"I know you didn't want to be here today, and I can understand why you might not have much faith in yet another mental health professional, but I'm interested. What is it you'd like me to do about your parents?"
"Tell them to leave me alone," he growled.
"I'm fine."
"Yes, he's got everything under complete control," the father said sarcastically.
"Please,"
Mitchell boomed.
"If I told them to leave you alone, do you think they would?" the therapist asked.
"No,"
he glared at his parents.
"I don't."
"Is it fair," the therapist said, speaking carefully, "to say that your interactions with your parents are very frustrating for you?"
Mitchell turned to his parents.
"You found another genius," he said. "We need to pay money and waste our time on this guy telling us the obvious."
"Mitchell," said the father, "don't be rude."
"Stop telling me what to do," Mitchell boomed.
"I appreciate your looking out for me," the therapist said to the father. but I actually want to hear what Mitchell has to say. The therapist looked back at Mitchell. I don't think I can get them to leave you alone without you being here. I don't think you can get them to leave me alone with me being here, Mitchell said. Then he paused for a moment. How often do I have to come? He asked. Well, to start, I'd like you to come every other week, the therapist said. I'd like your parents to come every week. Is that reasonable? Fine, he said. Can we leave now? I'd like to spend a few more minutes with your parents, but you can wait outside if you'd like. Mitchell left the office. We've got a lot of work to do, the therapist said. My initial impression is that Mitchell is extremely irritable, pretty black and white, and doesn't have a very good sense of how he's coming across. He's tried to kill himself once. Twice, interjected the mother. He's tried twice in the same year. Twice, the therapist continued. He's got very high expectations academically, but some significant learning issues getting in the way. He isn't satisfactorily medicated at the moment, and he has no faith in the mental health profession, and there is a particular trigger that seems to set him off very reliably. What is it? The mother asked. You guys, the therapist replied. There was a long pause. Finally, the mother said, Where do we start? Well, I need more information about a lot of things, the therapist said, but one thing is certain, we're not going to get anywhere unless I can establish a relationship with him. And we're going to help you guys learn how to communicate and collaborate so that Mitchell's interactions with you guys aren't so frustrating for all of you. Oh, would you say there's some tension in our family? The father said sarcastically. A little bit, the therapist smiled. So we come back next week, asked the mother. You do, the therapist said. At this point, you might be thinking, wow, I don't have it so bad. Or, what? He thinks we don't know what explosions look like? Or, can we please get on with the show here? What do I do? Just remember, the most important part of what you do is to identify your child's pathways and triggers. Otherwise, you can't possibly know exactly what to do. But before we get to what you do next, we've got one more avenue to explore. Why what you've done already may not have been well matched to the needs of your child.
Chapter 5. The Truth About Consequences.
You know, first we thought Amy was just a willful, spoiled kid, when Father recalled. We had all these books and TV personalities and our pediatrician telling us that if we were simply firmer and more consistent with her, things would get better. Of course, Amy's grandparents added their 2 cents. They were constantly telling my wife and me about how Amy would have been handled in the good old days. So we did the whole sticker chart and timeout routine for a long time. It makes me shudder to think of how much time that poor kid spent in timeout. But we were told the lessons we were trying to teach her would sink in eventually. Sometimes she wouldn't stay in the timeout, and she'd try to kick us and bite us when we tried to hold her there. When we'd confine her to her room, she'd become destructive. We couldn't figure out what we were doing wrong. So we went from doctor to doctor, looking for answers. One doctor said Amy's tantrums were just her way of getting our attention, and told us to ignore the tantrums and give her lots of attention for good behaviors. But ignoring her didn't help her calm down when she was frustrated about something. I don't care what the experts say. You can't just ignore your kid while she's being destructive and violent. Another doctor, this was around when she was 8 years old, told us Amy had a lot of anger and rage. Amy spent the next year in play therapy with this therapist, trying to figure out what she was so angry about. He sort of ignored us when we told him Amy wasn't angry all the time, only when things didn't go exactly the way she thought they would. He never did figure out why she was so angry. The last person we went to was a child psychiatrist. We weren't all that enthusiastic about the idea, but she thought medicine might help Amy hold it together better. We figured we had nothing to lose. But when the first medicine didn't get the job done, she added another. Then another. Maybe there are some kids who do well on meds, but Amy wasn't one of them. All she had to show for all that medicine was an extra 30 pounds. In the meantime, We're still trying to figure out how to live with a kid like this. We've done everything we've been told to do. We've paid a big price. And I'm not just talking about money. Listening to different professionals and trying strategies that weren't on target. All along, we were convinced that her explosions were our fault. If it's our fault, how come our other two kids are so well-behaved? Psychology and psychiatry are imprecise sciences, and different mental health professionals have different theories and interpretations of explosive behavior in children. As you now know, children may exhibit such behavior for any of a variety of reasons, so there's no right or wrong way to explain it or no one-size-fits-all approach to changing it. The key is to find explanations and interventions that are well-matched to individual children and their families. Probably the most recommended and widely used approach to understanding and changing the behavior of explosive children, the conventional wisdom, is what can generically be referred to as the standard behavior management approach. There are a few central beliefs associated with this approach. The first is that somewhere along the line, non-compliant children have learned that their tantrums, explosions, swearing, screaming, and destructiveness bring them attention or help them get their way by coercing or convincing their parents to give in. This belief often gives rise to the notion that explosions are planned, intentional, purposeful, and under the child's conscious control. He's a very manipulative kid. He knows exactly what buttons to push, which in turn often causes adults to take the behavior very personally. Why is he doing this to me? As you read in Chapter 2, a corollary to the belief that such behavior is learned is that the child has been poorly taught or disciplined. What the child needs is parents who are willing to give him a good kick in the pants. Parents who become convinced of this often blame themselves for their child's explosive behavior. It must be us. We must be doing something wrong. Nothing we do seems to work with this kid. Finally, if you believe that such behavior is learned and the result of poor parenting and lax discipline, then it follows that it can be unlearned with better and more convincing teaching and discipline. In general, this unlearning and reteaching process includes 1. Providing the child with lots of positive attention to reduce the desirability of negative attention. 2. Teaching parents to issue fewer and clearer commands. 3. Teaching the child that compliance is expected and enforced on all parental commands, and that he must comply quickly because his parents are going to issue a command only once or twice. 4. Implementing a record-keeping system, points, stickers, happy faces, and the like, to track the child's performance on specified target behaviors, such as complying with adult commands, doing homework, getting ready for school, brushing teeth, and so forth. 5. Delivering consequences, rewards, such as allowance money and special privileges, and punishments, such as timeouts and the loss of privileges, contingent upon the child's successful or unsuccessful performance. And 6. Teaching the child that his parents won't back down in the face of explosions. This conventional approach isn't magic. It merely formalizes practices that are considered important cornerstones of effective parenting, being clear about how a child should and should not behave, consistently expecting and insisting upon appropriate behavior, and giving a child the incentive to perform such behavior. Some parents and their children benefit enormously from these programs, find that the above procedures provide some needed structure and organization to family discipline, and end up sticking with the program for a long time. Other parents may not stick with the formal behavior management program for long, but still change some fundamental aspects of their approach to parenting, and therefore become more effective at teaching and motivating their children. Still, other parents may embark on a behavior management program with an initial burst of enthusiasm.